Hello and welcome everyone to another very special episode of Podcast Them Softly. This is Nick, and today I am joined with Tim Fugale from Podcast Them Softly as well. How you doing,
Hello.
Tim?
Great, great.
Today on the show, we are joined with Piet Gelderblom from the Netherlands. He is the filmmaker, editor, movie buff, extreme fan who is responsible for recutting Brian De Palma's 1992 thriller Raising Cain, which stars John Lithgow, Lolita Davidovich. It's just one of those great, crazy movies, psychological thrillers, suspense films that De Palma is, so well known for making. That genre really is just, his claim to fame. And Raising Cain, while loved by many De Palma purists and completists, was seen as sort of a, mixed artistic, failure, triumph, what have you, very mixed reviews. It did decent box office, but nothing spectacular. But what Piet was able to do was get to the essence of what De Palma was trying to do when he was making the film. And through a variety of means and methods, which we'll find out more about, he put together an alternative cut of Raising Cain, which De Palma then saw and gave his full blessing to. So without further ado, we're going to we're going to introduce him here, and he's going to tell us all about his project. So, Piet, thank you very much for joining us for a chat. And, really, how did this all come about?
Hi there, Nick. How did this all come up? I was just curious to see if I could pull this off. There was a time that I was the founder of a website called 24 Lies a Second. And it was a very De Palma dominated website. It featured writing, and it featured a forum full of people who were into De Palma. And at a certain moment, there was this French guy who had just finished an interview book with Brian De Palma. And the book wasn't out yet, but he told us that Brian De Palma wasn't really happy with the theatrical cut of Raising Cain. And I was immediately interested because when I saw it back in 1992, I loved the movie, but I was together with a girlfriend and she hated it. And I could actually understand her because the movie becomes pretty insane within the first 3 or 4 minutes. And, you could also sense in the theater that the people who were watching, they weren't really getting it because, it was almost like the madness started too soon. And, so when that movie was over, I thought, well, this was just one for the fans, it's an acquired taste, and I happen to really love this movie, but it's probably too much for for normal people. And so when I heard about De Palma having reservations about this theatrical cut, I was immediately very curious what would be different. And I asked this French guy called Laurent Frechaud, what was the difference? And the only thing he said, well, the real story, the real screenplay actually started with the story of the wife, Jenny. So it doesn't start with Carter or Cain, but it starts with the wife. And yeah, almost immediately, I was thinking a lot of things at the same time, but I was convinced, like, of course, that this is the way it should be. I immediately saw that if you would start with the story of the wife, it would have a structure more similar to Dress to Kill, more similar to Psycho, and it will actually be a little more of a slow burn, so it would allow the audience to get into the story And when the madness does happen, they will probably be ready for it. But that started a process, and I didn't really think of re-editing the movie myself until a few years later. But at a certain moment, I just became too curious, and I wanted to see how such a version would play out.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of the things, your recut certainly does feel in many respects even more Hitchcockian than the initial cut. And you know, that's been one of the things about De Palma's work. He's been so often compared to a modern day Hitchcock. He's clearly worn his inspirations and his obsessions for Hitchcock's work on his sleeve. And it's funny that you mentioned when you saw the film with your girlfriend at that time. There was such a strong division between your response, you know, you being a big fan and she not. And that's one of the things that's really come to characterize Brian De Palma's work throughout the years, is you speak to people who are huge fans and absolutely love him and really no movie is bad kind of deal. You can always find something great in some of the more, you know, overall misguided efforts. And then you have people who are just like, no way, like he's too much. I don't like his style. And you're not really going to move them too much on their opinion. What do you think it is about De Palma's work that creates such a rift in people's responses?
I think the main reason is that he is quite a postmodern filmmaker in the sense that he can show you something while at the same time he is commenting something. Let me try to explain this. You have warm filmmakers like Steven Spielberg, and you have cold filmmakers like Stanley Kubrick. And the cold ones, they have a more detached style, and they're actually presenting stuff in a very objective way, so that you really have to think about what is this thing I'm seeing here. And with the warm kind of filmmakers, they're really drawing you in and making you part of what is going on in the movie. And De Palma, in a very funny way, he is both. He is a very passionate guy. He uses sex and blood and all those kind of things to, and he also uses good characters to draw you in. And at the same time, he's very ironic and distant and cold and manipulative. And I think probably his best movies, he finds the right balance, and it works for it works for a lot of people, but it can also some people just don't like it. They just want to be into the movie, and then all of a sudden an ironic joke comes up, or he's referencing other movies, for example, and it pulls them out of it. And it's a very delicate balancing act, and it works. For some movies, it works better than for others, I guess.
Pete, I had a quick question for you. I was reading your essay that you wrote on the cut that you did, I think, for IndieWire a few years back.
Yeah.
And you mentioned at the time, you know, the 1992 when it came out, there wasn't a lot of fractured narrative going on in American cinema. You know, it was very three-act, straightforward stuff. And that since then, we've seen a lot more of that come into play. And you mentioned specifically, I think, you know, a David Lynch film, and it really struck me. It was like there are so many elements of what De Palma does and plays with that Lynch does as well, yet Lynch is always kind of lionized as this ultimate surreal noir filmmaker, when De Palma has been doing surreal noir for as long, if not longer. Do you think maybe he deserves more credit in that kind of genre than he gets?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the reasons why some people are not into his filmography is that that they don't really get, that his movies are all about dreams within dreams and all of that stuff. And he's been doing that for a long time. And it's true that when you see sometimes sorry about this. I am from the Netherlands, so sometimes I have to think about what to say in English. Help me out again. We were speaking about.
I was just, I guess the point that hit me is that in the time since Raising Kane came out, and granted the original cut is more kind of standard three-act, and it didn't work that well for a lot of audiences, and since then, you know, David Lynch, Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, they have, there's a whole kind of group of filmmakers who get a lot of credit for not just fractured narrative, but for playing with a lot of the same elements. Surrealist surprise and noir and things like that, and it struck me as I was reading about what you went through making the cut and what you've seen since then, that De Palma just doesn't seem to get the same kind of credit as those filmmakers do, despite the fact he's continued to be relatively prolific. You know, he's continued to put out movies. Maybe not as maybe he's not getting budgets as easily as some of his other peers. But I was just wondering what your thoughts were on him really launching kind of a lot of filmmaking careers, like a David Lynch or a Tarantino or some of these other ones, and not getting the credit for it that he deserves.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's absolutely true. And in fact, it's also the case with Raising Kane. In Raising Kane, he started to doubt himself, actually, because he wanted to make this dream narrative. And it would feature a flashback, which is, I believe, something around 20 minutes or so. And at the time, that was pretty crazy. And De Palma just came back from Bonfire of the Vanities, which, of course, became a big flop. And when this movie was tested, it didn't do very well with the audience that were seeing it. And he started to De Palma started to doubt himself. And he sort of backed off on this dream narrative with the huge flashback, and he made it chronological. And by that, he made it a little bit, a little more boring as well, I guess. But you're absolutely right. He is still very underrated. De Palma is incredibly important to cinema, and has been a huge influence on a number of filmmakers.
I would agree completely with you guys, and I think that one of the big things about De Palma's work, and this is his work can be seen this year. There's a documentary that was released. It's now available on disc streaming. It's simply called De Palma. It's a fabulous documentary. Filmmakers Noah Baumbach and I think it was Jake Paltrow. I think they got together and made a documentary all about De Palma's work and dissecting each movie, you know, piece by piece. And it's really just an informative, amazing, entertaining, you know, view of this man's work. And, you know, given that he came up with, you know, Lucas, you know, Spielberg, Coppola, you know, Schrader, all of those guys that were, you know, just plowing through the studio system, he always had a very different sensibility, way more heightened melodrama, which I still don't think that audiences really know how to respond to, you know, especially modern audiences. They just don't get that kind of stuff. And he was making films that were commenting, and he always has. He makes films that comment on themselves and on the process of filmmaking, which can be completely lost on, you know, the casual moviegoer. And for some people, you know, strikes as, you know, pretentious and annoying. You know, for me, given that I love his films, I love all of his movies, and my favorite movies of his are the ones that dabble in the, you know, the dream world and the dream logic, and the ones that are expressly odes to, you know, Alfred Hitchcock, and, you know, especially Vertigo and, you know, Obsession and everything else. And, you know, my favorite movie that De Palma has done remains to be Femme Fatale. Because for me, that is just the ultimate synthesis of, you know, his obsessions and desires as a filmmaker, filtered through that dream, you know, that dream logic narrative. And again, I just think that audiences don't know how to react to the artifice that De Palma proudly shows. You know, a lot of filmmakers want to hide the filmmaking. It needs to be invisible. Well, De Palma wants you to feel it and see it up front. Right. And he wants you to know that you're watching a movie. And as Tim said, there's some people that just want to sit back and watch a movie and not be reminded that they're watching a movie. Well, De Palma wants to remind you about the conventions that he's either exploiting or subverting. And with Raising Cain, I think that you had a filmmaker who, like you said, was, you know, doubting himself. I've learned more about this, you know, this particular area of his career just by, you know, reading your stuff and watching your, you know, video on it and watching the recut and everything. It's truly amazing work what you've done. But it's just, I just have to imagine as a fan of being someone who's just in love with De Palma's work the way that you have been, you know, how rewarding was it to spend the amount of time that you spent putting this together and then, you know, posting it on IndieWire, if I recall correctly, is where it initially was posted. And then De Palma saw it and then just basically like, what do? They call you and like, you know, like tell you like, you know, holy shit, wow, you cracked the egg. Like what happened?
No, I wish that would happen. No. He's very, he's always online and checking things, and he's very, you know, he's a computer nerd, so he knows about everything that's going on. And I started about a year after it was posted on IndieWire, I started seeing in interviews, I counted five, in which he actually mentioned my recut and said that he liked it very, very much. And he was saying things like, well, I should have left it that way, and you know it's great, and he put it back together the way it was meant to be, which was already very rewarding. But at a certain moment, the Shout Factory Blu-ray was actually announced on a website called The Palma à la Mort, and he regularly checks that website, and he saw the news. And he watched the recut again. And after that, he sent an email to the guy behind the Palma à la Mort called Jeff Baran. And he said, well, I just watched Raising Cain recut. I think it's great. It's succeeding in things that we couldn't do at the time of the theatrical release. And it's what I always wanted the movie to be. And I think it's important that it should be on this new Blu-ray. And, of course, Jeff, he knows me from the time that I had the website 24 Lies a Second. And he emailed me this particular email. And I just completely went berserk.
I'll bet.
It's just insane. It's like... I've already told this before, but it's like, you know, you do a remix of a Beatles album, and Paul McCartney is saying, hey, that kind of beats the way we did it. Shall we bring it out this way? It's just completely madness. Yeah, that's how it went. So Shout Factory... They were actually called by Brian De Palma. He didn't call me. He didn't contact me. He directly called Shout Factory, and he said that he wanted it on the Blu-ray. So after that, started a process of you know, that they of actually remaking the recut, but then in HD from the master, and that's a whole process that I supervised. Overseas, so they were doing it in LA, and they were sending me stuff, and I could send it back again, have some notes, and then that's the way we did it.
So, did you ultimately get final cut on that cut, or was De Palma back there with, you know, making the final decision?
He wasn't. De Palma, he signed a few papers actually to say like, well, I believe in this cut, and this is it. And he just left me to it. We never we never had contact again except for that email. And yeah, so this it's a strange thing because, of course, later on, they decided to pull it the director's cut, which was even more absurd. I loved it, of course. It just means that it's his preferred version, and it's a very great honor. But it's of course a little strange because he didn't actually make it himself. I was all right with it, you know, as long as some credit to me would be given, you know, I was all for it.
How long did it take you? How long did it take you to put together in your head how the movie should have finally been?
It was pretty quick, actually. I already had the sense that I immediately knew what the first shot of the movie would be if it would start with the story of the wife, and it's a shot that I've always really loved. And I immediately thought, okay, if that would be the start of the movie, that would actually make it a completely other viewing experience. And I suspected that when the story of the husband would be in would be introduced, it would probably be at a very specific moment where it would actually work as a surprise, and that's something I had to check. I started investigating in that, and I found a scan of the second draft of the screenplay, which was called Father's Day at that time, and I read it, and it convinced me that my thoughts were correct, and that it basically the structure that I had in my head was kind of the way that he envisioned it. But of course, this being a second draft of the screenplay, there were lots of things different to the actual theatrical cut. There were extra scenes in there as well, and big changes. But not all of those things that you could read in that screenplay were better than the final movie. That's because it is a second draft, and movies are never perfect in the beginning. You know, you're working on it and working on it, and then things fall into place. But in this case, things fell into place and then fell out of place again, and I just put things back into place again.
Were there any particular scenes from that second draft from Father's Day that you wish you would have had footage that you could have played with?
Yeah, sure. It would be intriguing to see. There was, for example, a marriage proposal, a flashback from Carter to Jenny. But it might have already been thrown away, actually, at the moment of shooting. I'm not sure. The more I've been thinking about it, the movie was tested, and it didn't test well. And because of that, De Palma changed a lot in the editing. He made things shorter, and he changed the order. I think the changing the order bit was a mistake, but the shortening part of it, it might not have been such a bad idea, actually, because maybe the movie in its original form, with a couple of more scenes in it, didn't flow as well as what the director's cut actually looks like now. It's a guess, but that's a guess. And it's not like I needed the scenes. The only thing that I needed at a certain moment was I had to be able to make one certain transition, and I didn't have an establishing shot of the park. And I was thinking, I need some kind of establishing shot, otherwise the audience will be completely lost at this moment. They will be saying, like, what am I watching here? I don't know what's going on. I don't know when this is. I don't know where this is. So I needed an establishing shot. But it's very funny, but De Palma, he doesn't do regular establishing shots. He doesn't do coverage. You know, whenever he shows, for example, a park, it will be a crane shot, and the crane shot will be going down and down and down, and actually it will arrive at two persons sitting on a bench, and that will be the beginning of a scene. So I needed this one transitional shot, but I didn't have it. And what I finally decided to do was to grab it, a shot from the park, which was a crane shot, and I stabilized it. So normally it has a movement in it, but I only show that shot for a short period of time, and then I stabilized the shot so that there's no movement of the camera, and then it works as an establishing shot. So that was a little trick that I had to pull off because I was missing something.
Well, how do you feel about De Palma, especially when we're working with the great cinematographer Stephen H. Burham? You know, when you look at Burham's credits, they're just mind-blowing in general, but the movies that he collaborated with De Palma on are some of, in my opinion, some of the best. How do you feel about De Palma's use of subjective camera, looking directly in the lens, regarding the camera, as obviously 98% of movies, you know, ignore the camera?
Yeah, what do I think of it? I love it, the way he does it. But as you said earlier, it is true that for some people it's sort of jarring. But I love it. He does, you know, he's not afraid to show you that this is a movie. He wants you to see the theatricality of it. And what I love about that is that certainly these days, I think a lot of movies that we see, they are very naturalistic and they are very based on realism. And everything has to be as naturalistic as possible. And when you go to a theater and you see an opera, it is wildly stylized and people completely accept it. Even like, you know, you have the Disney musical The Lion King, and it shows you people who are walking around with masks, with animal masks, and it works because it's theater. And I think De Palma is such a visual stylist within this medium. He's about, you know, he's one of the very few who can actually be so theatrical, but within the medium of cinema. And I think it's very worthwhile. Why should everything be completely realistic and dull if you can make it much more sensational?
And are you a fan of Hitchcock, considering that a lot of De Palma's stylistic tendencies and narrative thoughts, a lot of them have been, you know, they stem from the work of Hitchcock? Are you a fan?
Well, sure. I'm an admirer more than a fan, I should say. Hitchcock, of course, he's like, you know, he's untouchable. He made this whole language up that De Palma is actually using until this very day. But I'm more into the sensibility of De Palma. I think he's a little more baroque, and he's a little more over the edge, and he's just very, very interesting. And it annoys me that a lot of people have been saying for years and years and years that De Palma is a Hitchcock ripoff, because he's very honest about it. He shows you where his ideas are coming from.
Absolutely.
But then
he's excited at the possibility of being compared to Hitchcock. And in my opinion, you know, he's probably turned some people on to Hitchcock's work, you know, based on his own work. You know, and that's the thing. It's like you can rip off a filmmaker can rip off another filmmaker to the point of being unoriginal. And that's the thing about De Palma, is that his you know, what drives him as a storyteller and filmmaker can certainly be traced to, you know, other cinematic voices, but his movies live and breathe in a very specific Brian De Palma universe. And especially the films, in my opinion, like, you know, Dress to Kill, Body Double, Raising Kane. I'm trying to think about those, like that mid group of thrillers, you know,
Blowout.
Sisters, yeah. You know, there's always these common themes that you can run, you know, from each movie, you know, from movie to movie, both stylistically and narratively. He's an auteur, in my opinion, in the truest sense. Like, you just, if you know anything about film, you know anything about De Palma, you just, you know, pop a film on and boom, you know that you're watching a Brian De Palma movie. And, you know, for me, that's one of the most exciting things about the process of being a film lover, is, you know, discovering a body of work and becoming consumed by it and knowing that the filmmaker is in complete control. And even in the films that I personally feel don't work 100%, even though that they're not 100% great or they've got some flaws, I still feel like De Palma was going for it and not just slacking off and like being lazy and, you know, doing something just because he can. And that's one of the reasons why I think that he probably fell out of favor, you know, with the studios, is that his tastes, you know, they align to a certain degree, you know, to what the studios want to see these days. But he's an idiosyncratic voice, and those voices are tough to preserve within a studio system that is really interested in making money. And, you know, and you could probably count on one hand the movies that De Palma has directed that are considered, you know, for higher jobs or, you know, just, you know, and he brought flair to Mission Impossible, and he brought, you know, an interesting voice, you know, however creatively muddled some of Mission to Mars might be, in my opinion. He brought something distinctive to the table to some of these films that, you know, are maybe perceived as easy bets.
Sure.
And you know, that's something that I don't think a lot of filmmakers can lay claim to doing.
Sure thing. And also to go back to Hitchcock, it doesn't stop, he doesn't stop with the influence of Hitchcock. He takes it further. He inverts stuff. Like, if you look at Body Double, that's an inverted Vertigo. He always twists things around, and he does it really in his own way. So he's not just blatantly copying. He's always putting a different spin on it.
Yeah, there's always a reason for him, you know, to call out, and it's not, again, it's not like he's doing a highlight reel of, you know, somebody else's work. When you were putting this together and it was done, what was your greatest hope that could come of this? Like, did you ever dream that De Palma would catch wind of it, see it, and, you know, let alone approve it and, you know, wave his magic wand on it?
Oh, gee, if you would have asked me then, I would probably say yes. But I don't think actually that would ever happen. I just it didn't enter my mind that that would be a possibility. But in a way, I did this because I was curious, but I also did it because I am a filmmaker myself, and sometimes it's hard. You know, people watch a movie and they think, okay, that's the movie, and it sucks or it's great, and that's it. But there's a lot of stuff going into a movie, and there's a lot of concessions that have to be made, and sometimes you have to go a little bit to the left, and sometimes you have to go a little to the right, and sometimes that's good and it becomes something better, and sometimes not. And this was a case. I was in my house. I was just curious. I had this DVD, and I put it into the computer, and I changed the orders the order of scenes because I had nothing to lose. Whereas De Palma, he was a man under pressure when he made this movie, and he started changing things around. And in a way, this was my way of showing to De Palma your initial thoughts about this story were correct, and you should have held on to them, and see this is how it ends up if you did. So that was what I was thinking. I was not literally thinking, okay, De Palma is going to call me up and say that it's great, but I used this this recut as a way of expression to kind of communicate my thoughts about this project to someone whose work I love so dearly.
Everybody should check out Pete's website, Directorama, directorama.net, www. Very cool site. You can learn a little bit more about Pete and his work. What do you have going on coming up in the future? Any projects you can share?
Well, apart from my usual work, I do a lot of commercials and documentaries and television. I'm actually working on two video essays at the same time right now, and one of them will be De Palma oriented, the other one will not. They will be quite something. I will hope to publish them before the end of the year or maybe in the beginning of next year. I don't want to spoil what they will be about, but I think there will be a lot of fun.
Awesome. We look forward to seeing them.
Right.
Yeah, and everybody grab the recently released Shout Factory 2-disc Blu-ray special edition, which includes De Palma's original theatrical cut as well as Pete's newly formed director approved fan edit, recut, whatever you want to call it. It's amazing. I think that it's probably anybody's dream to, fall in love with a filmmaker, their body of work, watch a movie, think in their head, wow, maybe I could improve upon it, and then have the filmmaker, actually give it that big fat wet sloppy kiss, which is definitely what happened here. So thank you so much, Pete, for chatting with us and talking to us about De Palma and his work. It's obviously that you're a big fan and you've got a lot of passion for the subject, and we wish you nothing but the best of success with all your upcoming projects.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, our pleasure.